Hey, good morning, everybody. Oh, I need my mic. Check. Oh, that's good. All right, we're going to get started. This is Bio 231. It's Monday, October 5th, and we're going to look at some muscles today. I want to finish up on introduction to muscles. Blackboard. I have some really nice animations in Blackboard, but the links are broken, and I just found where they exist, so I'll upgrade Blackboard in a little bit. But I do want to show you some of those animations after we look at the schedule. All right, so indeed, today is the 5th. We're going to proceed from chapter 10 into 11. So today and Wednesday is 11, and then 1 week from today is your second lecture exam. And the people that have lab on Monday will also have the second practicum on the same day, either before or after the lecture exam. And for the chapters for the lecture exam, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11. The labs for the second practicum are 4, 5, and 6. All right, and then the Wednesday group gets a practicum on Wednesday, the 14th. All right, so 1 week from today, a couple tests are going to happen. All right, so does anybody have a question about what we talked about last time? Not necessarily. Okay. Let's take a look at this. We were looking at a sarcomere last time, and maybe I'll go to the dual mode projection so that everybody can see this. And I'm going to have to turn the volume down because I don't want the audio to come through. All right, these are narrated, so you can watch them. And here I see a sarcomere. Where does a sarcomere begin and end? What are the endpoints? The Z line. So here's a Z line, and here's a Z line. So you believe me that that's a sarcomere? Indeed, right? And on either side of the Z line is that I band, and it's an I band only because it has these very thin filaments, and the thin filaments are called, go ahead, tell me, not labeled on this slide, but you should know, actin. And then in the center, you have the thick filaments, and so that's going to produce a dark band, which we call the A band, and the thick filament is what kind of protein? Myosin, that's right. Myosin has these head groups, see right here and right here, and when calcium floods through the myofibril, that head group can reach up and grab hold of actin, and if there's ATP, then these things are going to flex and pull actin toward the midline. All right, so what else do we see? Well, the H zone here is in the middle. Oh, here says sarcomere. That's really nice. So as this thing starts to contract, the H zone should disappear, and the I band should get smaller and smaller and smaller. So let's see if that's exactly what happens. Oh, what's happening? Audio? Oh, I guess I could turn it off just like that. Okay. All right, so these things, are you're going to see them start to almost like to row, right? So it grabs the actin and they flex, like so, and then they let go, reach forward again, grab hold of actin, and that process just repeats itself over and over and over again. All right, and so what happened to the H zone? It's gone, right, because now there's complete overlap between actin and myosin, and that produces a very dark band. There's just a little bit of the I band left, and so you should say the I band is reduced and the H band goes away. And on this particular animation, you can see which protein shortens. Is it the myosin or the actin? Is it the actin or myosin that has gotten shorter? How about if I grab this little slider? All right, that's what it was at the beginning. All right, so here's myosin before. What about myosin? Do you see myosin getting shorter? I don't see myosin getting shorter. All right, what about actin? Here's the actin before. Does it get shorter? Okay, right here they join together, so there are two actins. Let me move it back just a little bit. Now you can see them separate. What about the actin? Did it get shorter? No. So how would you explain that these Z lines got closer together, which means that this muscle contracted? How would you explain contraction if you know actin and myosin? The sliding filament mechanism. That's how we explain how a sarcomere gets shorter and shorter. Okay, so that's all I want to say about a sarcomere. Anybody have a question about that? Actin and myosin just slide over each other. That's the sliding filament mechanism. Okay, let's go back to the dual screen projection once again. And I want to take a look at the knee. I want to go over the knee with you. This right here is an exam figure. Right? But before we get to this one, I want to show you an illustration of a knee before we do any dissection on it. And this thing right here, you can palpate, that's your kneecap, but otherwise we know it as the patella. That's the patella. It's a sesamoid bone. It's embedded in this tendon, right? And that's interesting. Most bones are not embedded within a tendon. So a muscle-to-bone connection is a tendon. These things right here are big, powerful muscles in your anterior thigh. There's four of them. I see three. There's one deep to the one that's right smack in the middle. So four of them together are what we call the quadriceps. And they're in the femoral region, quadriceps femoris muscle. When they contract, they pull on the tendon of the quadriceps that pulls on the patella. Then the patella pulls on this ligament, right? So here is the patellar ligament. And then that pulls on the tibial tuberosity. Remember tibial tuberosity right here? I'm going to run out of voice. Let me get the volume back up. All right, tibial tuberosity is on what bone? Yeah, it's on the tibia. Indeed it is. And it's a really large process, right, because those big, powerful muscles are pulling on it. All right, so I see one muscle, so we're going to call that the quadriceps. I see one tendon and one ligament, and I do see how many bones. How many bones do we see on this illustration? I like that. I see four. I see the fibula, the tibia, the patella, and then it's not labeled. There is the femur. Here's the femur. Yep. Okay, so we're looking at the knee. There's two other ligaments that I see very nicely that you have to know. There's one medial and lateral. The lateral one goes to the head of the fibula, and the medial one goes to the tibia. And they just go straight up and down. These are what we call collateral ligaments in the knee. All right, so I see one, two, three ligaments. These others you don't have to know about. You do have to know about this tendon and this ligament right here. So let's cut this tendon right about here and reflect the patella down in front of the tibia and so that we can look inside the joint. All right, so we're going to do that just like so. And then we've also bent the knee, we flexed the knee so that we can look inside. So here's that patella reflected down. Here's the tendon of the quadriceps. Here's the patellar ligament. Do you remember what those looked like before we did our dissection? And then the vertically aligned ligaments. Here's the fibular collateral ligament. And then here is the tibial collateral ligament. But you could also call the tibial collateral ligament by its location, right? And is this medial or lateral where I have the cursor right now? Okay, so you know that because you know that the tibia is medial and the fibula is lateral. So you could call this the medial collateral ligament, and you could call this one the lateral collateral ligament, right? The collateral ligaments are there because the knee is, for this class, just a nice simple hinge joint. It just flexes and extends. And it should not abduct or adduct, right? The tibia shouldn't move out this way, right? That would be adduction. Tibia shouldn't move out laterally. That would be abduction. So these are the ligaments that prevent, right, the abduction and adduction of the knee under most circumstances. If somebody is hit in the leg really hard, from the inside and it bends the leg laterally, okay, then it is the medial collateral ligament that breaks when that happens. Or if somebody is hit from the side, right, and the leg moves to midline, then it's the lateral collateral ligament that gets ripped, right, damaged, or maybe pulled off of these bones. All right, so those are the collateral ligaments. But remember, the knee should only flex and extend. What do we call that motion if the leg was actually going to move in front of the thigh? All right, so if the leg moves like that, in front of the thigh, what do we call that motion? You do that with your jaw. What's that? Protraction. The knee shouldn't protract, and it shouldn't retract either. So there are ligaments that prevent that motion. These are called the cruciate ligaments because they cross over each other. Here's the anterior cruciate. Here's the posterior cruciate. They insert into what the intercondylar eminence on the tibia, and they come from the notch in the femur. And the reason why the anterior cruciate ligament is there is that it prevents protraction, and the posterior prevents retraction. But if somebody's hit really hard in the front of the leg, right, and pushes the leg posterior while the femur is held still, then it's that anterior cruciate ligament that gets damaged. And conversely, if somebody is standing still and they get hit in the leg and it protracts, then it is the posterior cruciate ligament that gets damaged. But of course, you can have a combination of those motions, and so you can have a combination of those injuries to these different ligaments, right? And why do you know that this cruciate, posterior cruciate ligament, or this anterior cruciate ligament, how come you know that these are ligaments? How would you convince me that they're a ligament? It's a bone-to-bone connection, right? So ligament is a bone-to-bone connection. Yeah, question.
You said the anterior cruciate ligament prevents retraction or
protraction. Anterior prevents protraction, and the posterior cruciate prevents retraction under most circumstances, right? Unless you get hit really hard, then these things will rip. All right, so what's the medial bone in the leg once again?
Tibia.
Tibia, nice. And where would you find the medial malleolus? It's not shown on this particular slide, but you should know. Yeah, it's on the tibia, right? That's that ankle bone, the middle ankle bone sticking out right there. Go ahead and reach down and grab it if you want to, just to practice what's medial. All right, and then the lateral malleolus is going to be on the fibula. You can't see the malleoli, you can't see the head of the femur, so you definitely got to know that the tibia is medial and the fibula is lateral. Because when we look at the condylar surfaces of the femur, right, here is the lateral condylar surface of the femur. Here is the medial condylar surface covered with nice hyaline cartilage. Now, these condyles on the femur don't rub up against the tibia because there's something that prevents that from happening. There's some extra cartilage, right? There is an articular disc. There's actually two of them, and they're called menisci in the knee. And these are C-shaped cartilages, and they're a really strong kind of cartilage. Who remembers the strongest kind of cartilage? What is the strongest kind? Fibrocartilage. I think somebody told me fibrocartilage, and indeed. The knee menisci are fibrocartilage. But remember, cartilage, even if it's the strongest kind, is never going to be as strong as bone, so these things can get damaged. And we know this one over here, right, because the tibia is medial, this is the medial meniscus, and then over here, matches up with the fibula, that's the lateral meniscus. And if you look at this meniscus, you can see that it's sort of like a wedge. The thinnest part is going to be at the ends, right, the more medial parts of both of these, and then the thickest part is going to be on the edge over here. So where these menisci like to tear and rip are on these little really thin pieces that are poking into the knee. And they can even rip off, and you can have this like wedge-shaped piece of cartilage floating around in your knee. And guess what we use to prop a door open up in the anatomy lab, and even maybe here? We use a... Did anybody see that piece of wood, that block of wood? How would you describe that block of wood that we push underneath the door so the door doesn't close? It looks like a wedge. Right, it's really thin on one end, and it gets thicker and thicker and thicker, and that's just what this thing is right here. And that little wedge can lock a knee in position too if it gets ripped off. All right, so if there is a tear or a rip, then surgically that has to be, that piece has to be removed and or repaired. And it used to be where if somebody had a ripped meniscus, they would just remove the whole meniscus from the knee. All right, but when that happens, then the femur touches the tibia, and that then created a very early onset of arthritis in the knee for those people. All right, so now if you have a ripped meniscus, they remove just the smallest amount of meniscus possible, and that retains the most of the function, or as much function as possible for this meniscus. All right, so the knee is pretty easy because it just aligns itself on a nice grid, right, superior, right and left, or medial and lateral, so it's pretty easy to see this knee on the inside. Does anybody have a question on the knee in particular? Pretty good as far as labeling goes. All right, you should also probably be familiar with which ligament prevents adduction, which one prevents adduction, which one prevents protraction, and which one prevents retraction. That would be nice to know as well. Okay. All right, so we're done with joints, and we're going to look at, let's start looking at some muscles once again. Okay, so here's a nice review. Here's a muscle that causes the forearm to bend up to the arm. What do we call that motion? That's flexion. How do you know that's flexion? What's the definition of flexion? When there's an angle that is decreasing when something moves, right? So when your arm is straight, it's 180 degrees. As the forearm starts to bend anteriorly and superiorly, we call that flexion. And so here you have the forearm in this position. How about if we bring it straight down again? What's that motion called? I'd have to change this arrow. I have to put the head of the arrow over here. Straightening the arm out would be extension, right? Okay. So when the forearm moves, the humerus is held in position by some other muscles, so the humerus hardly moves at all when this brachialis contracts. So this end of the brachialis is what we call the origin. It's the end of a muscle that hardly moves at all. That's the origin. And the insertion is the end of the muscle that produces the most motion. Almost all muscles have an origin and insertion. That's not always the case, but I would say almost 100% of the time this is true. All right, so don't forget origin and insertion, because we'll have to know a bunch of that stuff for lab, and probably even for lecture if it's in your lecture notes. All right, well, we looked over that sarcomere, and these are the only pictures in this particular chapter. I do want you to be able to know the difference between skeletal muscle, cardiac muscle, and smooth muscle, and you see some nice micrographs right now of these different muscles. And of course, they're labeled, right? So it's going to be easy to tell. But in lab, you've already been tested on this in lab, but you should know, maybe for multiple choice questions, something about these muscles. So tell me something about skeletal muscle. That somebody, it's striated, that is nice. And that striation is shared by another kind of muscle, which is cardiac muscle. But is smooth muscle striated? It is not. Cardiac muscle and skeletal muscle are striated because it has sarcomeres. Smooth muscle does not have sarcomere arrangement. It has actin and myosin, but in a different kind of arrangement, not a sarcomere. So we don't see striations. All right, what else about skeletal muscle? What's another characteristic? I think I heard long. Did I hear long from somebody? It's long and linear. It's not branched, right? And so we call it a fiber. A skeletal muscle cell and a fiber are exactly the same thing. Now, cardiac muscle, look at this branch right here. Cardiac muscle is branched. And so that's an important difference. And the skeletal muscle cell is really long. So I only see one cell when I move from right to left, but cardiac muscle cells are relatively short. So I see the beginning of a muscle cell and an ending right here, and then there's another cell that starts right next to it. And so this is a special junction between cardiac muscle cells so that when they both contract, the heart doesn't rip apart. Anybody remember what these things are called? Yeah, intercalated discs. There's a couple kind of proteins. There are tight junctions and there are gap junctions in here. So it's a really nice specialized surface connection between muscle cells. But for now, you should know that it's called an intercalated disc. All right, so how is skeletal muscle controlled? Voluntarily, right, with your conscious thought. What about cardiac muscle? Involuntary. It's controlled by your autonomic nervous system. We're going to look at that in a couple of weeks. And smooth muscle. What is smooth muscle like? Cardiac or smooth in terms of control? It's very similar to cardiac muscle. That's right. You can't control smooth muscle. It's controlled by the autonomic nervous system as well. Okay, so that's how you would compare and contrast these different kinds of cells. Smooth muscle is short, cardiac muscle is short, skeletal muscle is long. Right. Another kind of funny thing about skeletal muscle is that there are many nuclei in each fiber that I can see right here. Right. And that's because during development, these were all different muscle cells that fused together to form a big, long, linear fiber. A cardiac muscle cell only has one nucleus, and a smooth muscle cell only has one nucleus as well. So when you want to think of a smooth muscle, right, it has a fusiform shape. It's not branched. A fusiform shape means that it has two pointy ends on either side. Think of a whale or a dolphin or a porpoise or something. The nose and the tail over here and the body is really thick. Or you could think of a football and grab the ends of a football and stretch it out. That will give you the kind of the shape of a smooth muscle cell. All right, so make sure you know the difference between skeletal, cardiac, and smooth. Did anybody run into any study questions on skeletal, cardiac, or smooth muscle yet? End of chapter, online questions? Anybody? Yes, maybe? Okay, they should be there. Okay. All right, so that's it for this chapter. Okay, here I can see the different kinds of muscle and skeletal muscle, cardiac and smooth muscle. Smooth muscle is in the wall of hollow organs. Cardiac muscle makes your heart. And then skeletal muscle is in more superficial parts of your body, not in body cavities. And it connects a bone to a bone. And when it contracts, it moves those bones together. All right. Sometimes that part of the body that is not deep inside of a body cavity is called somatic, right? So if you have sensation on the surface of your body, that's a somatic sensation, as opposed to maybe some other sensation that's deep inside a body cavity, that would be visceral, right? Inside, so the heart is a visceral organ, digestive tract is a visceral organ, skeletal muscle is a somatic organ, okay? Because it doesn't belong in a body cavity. All right, when we get to the nervous system, maybe I'll come back to this slide because I see something interesting here. Okay, so that's good for the muscle chapter. I'm going to put an animation in regarding this synapse as well. Okay, and so here is that synapse, and you'll be able to watch that animation. But let's go over this kind of quickly, right? Here is an electrical impulse coming down a nerve. That's what this arrow represents. Right? When that electrical impulse hits the end of the nerve, that's going to cause these vesicles that are filled with neurotransmitter to move over to the cell membrane. And when they fuse, these signaling compounds are going to be released into the space between the neuron and the muscle cell, and that's called the synaptic cleft. Or maybe we might want to call that the neuromuscular junction, right? And the synaptic cleft is part of the neuromuscular junction. the thing that happens when the electrical impulse comes down the axon, there is something that happens that signals, there's an intermediate step that signals the motion of these vesicles to the, what we call the presynaptic membrane, and that is calcium enters the cell. So when the nerve impulse comes down, calcium enters the nerve, and when calcium increases in the cytosol, then these vesicles move over and release neurotransmitter. They move by diffusion to the postsynaptic cell membrane, which is the sarcolemma of a skeletal muscle cell, and these signaling compounds bind to a receptor, and they match up by shape. So the receptor has to be complementary in shape to the shape of the signaling compound. And when that happens, then another electrical impulse starts on the surface of a muscle cell, and I can see it moving along the sarcolemma or the plasma membrane of that muscle cell. So this compound is called a neurotransmitter because it's secreted by a neuron, transmits a signal to the muscle, and there are a number of different kinds of neurotransmitters. This one here in all neuromuscular junctions is acetylcholine. That's the only neurotransmitter that's used. That's always abbreviated ACH. Okay. So then that nerve impulse, right, stays on the surface of the cell, but that won't cause contraction. That nerve impulse has to move deep inside each of these myofibrils, okay, deep inside the cell. And here is a tube that's very similar to the plasma membrane that moves in a transverse fashion, right, as opposed to axial fashion on the surface of the cell, transverse fashion, deep inside the cell. So we call this a transverse tubule. And when the nerve impulse, electrical impulse moves down the transverse tubule, it excites the smooth endoplasmic reticulum. Smooth endoplasmic reticulum is full of calcium ions, and then calcium is released into the myofibrils, and that's the signal where the filaments should start sliding sliding over each other. All right, so calcium is important for a couple of different reasons. It's important for muscle contraction, but it's also important for communication between cells. Right? Calcium has to enter the neuron in order for it to release acetylcholine. All right, so now you know actually three important reasons for calcium in your body. So you need it for synaptic transmission so cells can communicate with each other. You need calcium ions inside muscles so that they can contract, right, including cardiac muscle and smooth muscle as well. So all muscles need calcium to contract. And what's a third? Where's a third place that you need calcium? In bones. That's right. Okay. As we get older, we lose some control of calcium. We lose calcium from our bodies. And if you had to choose, right, where would you sacrifice calcium? Would you want to give away synaptic transmission so that nerves couldn't communicate with each other? Would you want to lose muscle contraction? Or would you choose to lose bone mass and have your bones get a little bit thinner and more brittle? Okay, it's a choice. You don't have enough calcium to go everywhere in proper concentrations. Where would be the first place that you would be willing to give away some calcium to support calcium in other parts of your body? And that is bones, right? Because you don't want to give away communication between cells. You don't want to give away muscle contraction. And so, unfortunately, as we get older, our bones have a tendency to get smaller and thinner and weaker as a result of that because we need calcium in other parts of our body. All right, so this is what we call excitation-contraction coupling. Excitation from this nerve, right, and finally to the release of calcium, and that causes the filaments to slide over each other. Okay, so that's the importance of calcium. All right, so that's good for this particular chapter. Let's move on to the next chapter so I can put this one away. So I'm going to close this down. Then we're going to move to next chapter. We're going to look at some muscles. Okay, so let's talk about some muscles by their shape. And this is going to be important because we're going to know the names of a number of different muscles. Sometimes we name a muscle by its shape. So that's going to be really handy. Here is a muscle. Then you can see that it's circular. We have a muscle like that around our mouth and around our eyes. A circular skeletal muscle is going to be called an orbicularis. Orbicularis. So the one around your mouth is orbicularis. The one around your eye is orbicularis. But of course they're two different muscles, so there's got to be another name. Right? The one around your mouth is called oris. Right? The one around your eye is called oculi. So orbicularis oculi would be a one around the eye, orbicularis oris around your mouth. That's circular. Some are convergent muscles, like the pectoralis major, where there's a very broad origin and a very small insertion. So all of these fascicles are converging to this one point for insertion. Right. A good example of another kind of muscle is called fusiform. And what does that mean, fusiform? It means that both ends are narrow, but the middle is wide, right? Kind of like a football, fusiform shape. A really good example of that would be the biceps brachii in your anterior arm. Some kind of look like a strap. All the fascicles are parallel to each other, and neither end is much thinner than the middle of this muscle. And a good example of that would be the sartorius. Right? And the sartorius, it just so happens to be the longest muscle in our body. Sartorius, we'll find out where that is. Okay, let's look at this one. Unipennate. A pennant kind of means a flag or a pennant. So here it would be like a flagpole. This tendon right here, nice linear tendon, would be like a flagpole, and then sticking off to one side, it reminded somebody of a flag. Look at all these fascicles joining to this one common insertion. And so this is what we call unipennant. If we had muscles on both sides of the tendon, then we would call that a bipennate muscle. And sometimes we might have a number of bipennate divisions of a muscle coming together, all right, and we would call this a multipennate muscle. So each one of these, right, are bipennate, but there's three of them in this particular illustration. So this would be a really good example of the deltoid muscle over the top of your shoulder. A bipennate, rectus femoris, right here in your thigh, and unipennate, which we can't really see, we have these in our hands. Right? So extensor digitorum longus. Also, when we name a muscle, if it's a straight muscle, we want to call it rectus. And if we look at the deltoid, it kind of looks like a triangle, and a triangle in Greek is delta. Right? So this is named after the shape of the muscle. Right, like fusiform, like circular, like parallel. And extensor digitorum longus. That's important to know because in the name it tells you a number of things. Right? Where are we going to find this muscle? In a digit, yeah, you're moving your hands, right? Around your digits, it's going to move a phalanx around somehow. Right? And what is the action of this extensor digitorum longus? It's going to cause extension of that digit. So that's going to be really handy. A lot of names of muscles are really easy because the action and maybe even the origin and insertion is part of the name. Right? So the action of this muscle is extension. You're going to find it in your fingers. And sometimes there are some that are short, there are some that are intermediate, but this one happens to be the longest of that whole group of muscles. Right, that's going to cause extension of a digit. OK.
Okay, muscle motions. I think we went over motions pretty well already. Okay, so let's look at, this is what you have to do in lab today. All right, so here are a bunch of head muscles. These will be on the next practicum coming up. And let's start with a couple muscles that might seem a little bit complicated. Right. One I want to point out right here is sternocleidomastoid. So sternocleidomastoid got its name because sterno refers to the sternum, cleido refers to the clavicle, and mastoid refers to the mastoid process. Right? And so this is a really nice muscle because the origin and insertion of this muscle is in the name, so you don't have to memorize it. And remember, if we combine terms in anatomy, what do we have to put between the terms if we're going to make one word out of it? N-O, right? So sternocleidomastoid. So the origin is the sternum and the clavicle, and the insertion is the mastoid process, right? Because these two things are together, far away from the mastoid process. So the origin is always the first part of the word, and the insertion is always the second part of the word when origin and insertion are used. All right, so you can imagine, here's that mastoid process kind of underneath your earlobe. Sternocleidomastoid moves anteriorly as it moves inferiorly. And so let's take another look at it. Here's a nice anterior look. All right, so here's the sternocleidomastoid. It's got what we call two bellies, one that goes to the sternum, the other to the clavicle. And when this muscle contracts, right, it's going to pull the mastoid process down toward the sternum. And so if the mastoid process moves down toward the sternum, okay, what can you tell me about the sternum and clavicle? Because only your head is moving. When sternocleidomastoid contracts, your head moves, but what about your sternum? Does it move? It does not. Okay. And so the origin, what's the origin of the sternocleidomastoid? It's the least movable end of the muscle. It is the clavicle and sternum, or you could even say manubrium. And what's the insertion? The mastoid process, and you know that because, right, mastoid is the last part of this term, but you also know by contracting that muscle. All right, but you have a sternocleidomastoid both right and left. We say that's bilateral. And so when both sternocleidomastoids contract, that causes flexion of the cervical spine, right? Or maybe a yes motion. If only one sternocleidomastoid contracts, right, it's going to cause a rotation. So if my right sternocleidomastoid contracts and my left relaxes, that's going to cause a right lateral rotation. If my left sternocleidomastoid contracts while the right relaxes, that's a left lateral rotation. Contracting together causes flexion. Okay, so that's a nice, easy muscle to know. Sternocleidomastoid. All right, here's another muscle. It's called the epicranius. And that's a nice descriptive term because it means right on top of the cranium, right? Epi means on top of, and cranium. I see that there are two divisions to it. There's one by the occipital bone, and there's one by the frontal bone. So sometimes we can refer to these as individual muscles. So the one by the occipital bone sometimes is called the occipital belly of the epicranius. Or if you want to talk about it by itself, we're going to call this the occipitalis muscle, occipitalis. All right. On the top of your head, you have no muscles. You have a very thin and broad tendon. And a broad, flat tendon is called the aponeurotica, and this one here is called the galea aponeurotica. It connects the occipital belly to the frontal belly. These muscles contract together. All right, and the only joint in your head that moves is the temporomandibular joint. So when this muscle contracts, there aren't bones that move together. Right, the frontal belly is connected to some skin above your eyebrows. So when this muscle contracts, it elevates your eyebrows. It's a form of communication when you elevate eyebrows. So that's the action. elevates the eyebrows. In your lab manual and on tests, I would like to call this the occipitofrontalis muscle as opposed to epicranius. Epicranius is a nice descriptive term, but occipitofrontalis tells you something important. What does that tell you, occipitofrontalis? The origin and insertion, right? And so remember, the origin is the first part of the word. The origin is going to be the occipitalis. The insertion is going to be the frontalis, and that's skin above the eyebrows. Right? It's elevating the eyebrows. All right, so occipitofrontalis, sternocleidomastoid, are really easy muscles to know. Here's a circular muscle around the eyes. What would you call a circular muscle? Circular muscle is an orbicularis. If it's around the eye, it's an oculi. If it's around the mouth, that is oris, right? And so when this muscle contracts, basically this that closes off the diameter of this muscle. So orbicularis oculi closes your eyes. Orbicularis oris closes your mouth, okay, or your lips together. A lip is called a labium, or labii for plural. So here is the superior labium, here is the inferior, and here's the muscle that closes the mouth. There are also muscles that open, right? And so here are some muscles that open. Levator labii superioris. So what's nice in that name, you have the location of the muscle and the action. You know it's going to be attached to a lip. That's the labii part. And superioris, right, because you have a superior and inferior lip, what's it going to be connected to? The superior lip. And what is the action? It elevates the upper lip, and right, I see it right here. Sometimes in lab, that might be a little bit hard to find because it has a tendency to be underneath the zygomatic muscles. Here are the zygomatic muscles that you'll have to know in lab. That also elevates the corners of the mouth. So that would be like a smiling muscle, the zygomaticus. There are some muscles that depress the lower lip, like the mentalis. Remember, that's the mental region. What did you have a foramen over here someplace? What was that? What was the name of that foramen, that hole? Mental foramen, yeah, because this is a mental region. Here's the mentalis, and then here is a muscle. It's attached to the lower lip, and when it contracts, it pulls the lower lip down, right? And so the name of this one is really nice. It's the depressor labii inferioris. So what lip does it work on? The inferior one, and we know it's a lip muscle because of labii, and what is the action? It depresses, right? It depresses the lower lip. Here's another one to the angle of the mouth, depressor anguli oris. Right, so it's going to go to the angle of the mouth and pull the angle of the mouth inferiorly. There's also a levator anguli oris, but it's not, is it on here? It's not on this slide, okay? And I don't think you have to know it in lab either. But a lot of these muscles we're going to see work in pairs. The joint that we said that moves in the skull is the temporomandibular joint. What are the motions? Can anybody tell me the motions of the TMJ or the motion of the mandible? What can a mandible do? It can elevate for chewing or depress for opening your mouth. Okay, so there are a number of muscles that elevate the mandible, and these are big, strong, powerful muscles. And I see two on this particular slide. Here is the temporalis. And then here is the masseter. Both of these elevate the mandible for grinding or chewing. There's a couple of others which are tucked away off the pterygoid processes of the sphenoid bone. And here is the lateral pterygoid, and here is the medial pterygoid. Right. So the lateral is for protraction, but all of these muscles, right? As far as I'm concerned in this class, you can say that these elevate the mandible. These are important for chewing. So the pterygoid muscles. The platysma, which is a really thin muscle that covers the whole anterior part of your neck, right, is one of just two muscles that can depress the mandible when it contracts, that helps open the mouth. We don't have an example of the platysma anywhere in lab because if it was left in position, you wouldn't be able to see a number of other muscles underneath it, right? So it's moved. It's in your lab manual because it's noteworthy because it's one of only two muscles that can depress the mandible. And we'd like to understand how muscles work, and we're going to learn muscles by either synergist properties or antagonistic properties. Antagonistic means that if there's a muscle that elevates the mandible, like masseter or temporalis, there should be one that depresses, right? You have elevators, masseter and temporalis, and then depressors, like the platysma. There's another one that's tucked up inside the mandible called the digastric. And antagonistic muscles are very important because they can precisely control your skeleton. Right? If you have antagonistic control over a particular bone, you have precise control and balance, which is very, very nice. Right? So as a matter of fact, it's a very important concept in control system theory. You have mechanisms in your car that are antagonistic to each other. And we could pick one. Does anybody know what kind of mechanisms in your car work against each other? And why would you have something that works against each other? It seems kind of futile for that to happen. Would be your gas pedal and your brake pedal, right? They're antagonistic to each other. But because of both of those working against each other, you have precise control of that automobile. Same thing for parts of your body. So this is a musculoskeletal example. We're going to see antagonism in the nervous system. And you would see that in molecular biology as well. Right, if there should be a nice complete control over system, it's maintained by antagonistic control. So, here is that sternocleidomastoid. It causes flexion of the neck, and we were saying that antagonistic control is so important. So if the sternocleidomastoid causes flexion, you would expect to have some muscles that do what to the neck? Because you don't want your head just flopping around on top of your body. You want to have precise control and balance with it, right? So if one causes flexion, like the sternocleidomastoid, what would you expect to find? One that causes extension, okay? And here it is right here, the splenius muscles. There are a couple of them, and you can see that the fascicle arrangement, right, they're different from each other. One will pull anteriorly, the other will pull posteriorly. The insertion is the same as the mastoid process. Right, so splenius capitis will cause extension, sternocleidomastoid flexion of the head. And we probably have a nice view right here. So here is anterior view of the neck. Here's the sternocleidomastoid for flexion. And if we look at the posterior view, here are the splenius muscles. Again, mastoid process, but now these go back, right, to the transverse processes of cervical and the first couple thoracic vertebrae, right, which will cause extension of the cervical spine. So those are nice antagonistic pairs. In lab, right, you also get to look at the scalene muscles. And there are a number of different scalenes, but we're going to treat these all as one particular muscle. And these don't go to a clavicle. They go to the first and second rib. First rib, second rib over here. The clavicle is missing, so I see the first rib and second rib. When these muscles contract, it helps elevate these ribs. And that's important for inspiration. When we want to inhale, okay, our thoracic cavity should be lifted laterally and also anteriorly, and it's these scalenes that help us inhale as a result of that. And after the test and after the practicum, we're going to learn about some muscles that are antagonistic to the scalenes. But that's not important right now. Okay, so if these are important for inspiration, we would want to find some muscles that are important for expiration. And we'll look at that pretty soon. All right, so those are some antagonistic muscles. Okay. Muscles in the back. All right, there are a whole bunch of muscles. And so I can see the semispinalis, right? We've got the semispinalis thoracic, multifidus, lumborum. Any muscles in the back right here, we're going to call these the erector spinae. Right, so one nice simple term. So any muscle in the back or any deep muscle in the back is going to be called erector spinae. And those muscles in the back, what does the splenius capitis do, which is in the posterior neck? What does the splenius capitis do? It causes? Okay. Sternocleidomastoid causes flexion. The splenius capitis causes extension. So all the posterior muscles here are going to cause extension of the vertebral column. Okay, so erector spinae are going to be extensors. Any of these right here in lab or lecture you could call erector spinae. That would be fine with me. And they're all going to cause extension. Where would we find some muscles that are going to cause flexion of the vertebral column? If all these in the back cause extension, where would we want to find some that cause flexion or produce flexion? So what we do is we just flip the body around and look in the opposite body compartment. All right, so if we want to find flexors of the vertebral column, okay, we're going to look in the anterior compartment. Here we are. All right, so here's the belly button. So do you believe me this is anterior? Yes, okay. Here is the rectus abdominis. What does rectus mean? It means straight, yep, straight up and down. And so when the rectus abdominis contracts, it opposes the erector spinae, so the action of the rectus abdominis is going to be flexion, right? So erector spinae cause extension of the vertebral column, rectus abdominis, flexion of the vertebral column. So that is one thing, one principle that I really would like to stress, and that is antagonistic muscles are going to be on opposite body compartments. If one is anterior on some part of your body, then the other one's going to be posterior, and that can be in the forearm or arm or trunk or thigh or leg. That's going to be an important consideration. All right, so let's look at a couple other antagonistic muscles. Let's look at some in the arm. So here is the biceps brachii. Right? Biceps means that it has two origins, and I can't see them on this illustration, but we're going to get rid of some of these other muscles in a little bit. And this is in your anterior arm. And y'all know that when you contract that muscle, it gets big and it bulges up. But what happens to your forearm when you do that? What is this motion at the elbow called? That's flexion, that's right. So if the biceps causes flexion in the anterior arm, right, where are we going to find something that's antagonistic to the biceps brachii? The posterior arm, right? And in the posterior arm, you have the triceps brachii. So the biceps and triceps are antagonistic to each other, but because of that antagonism, you have nice precise control of your forearm as a result. All right, so we're looking at the posterior side. Here is the triceps. And here is the biceps on opposite body compartments so that they are antagonistic to each other. The origin of the biceps. There are two origins. The coracoid process on the scapula. Maybe you can remember that. And then also there's a little tubercle right above the glenoid fossa, and that's called the supraglenoid tubercle. So that's why I wanted you to find that in lab, because that's an important origin of the biceps, right? And then the insertion is on the tuberosity of the ulna here. So when it contracts, right? It flexes the elbow. Triceps. Here is, okay, here's triceps, opposite body compartment, and one of the origins of the triceps is the infraglenoid tubercle. This one here, infraglenoid tubercle. So it's kind of interesting that the supra and infraglenoid tubercles are exactly opposite each other on either side of the glenoid fossa, and that's where the long heads of the biceps and triceps insert, right? Just because of symmetry. That's nice. Here is a muscle that goes across the elbow. Here's the brachialis. It doesn't go across the shoulder like the biceps does, right? And it's deep to the biceps brachii. And what body compartment do you see it? Is this anterior to the humerus or posterior to the humerus? It's anterior to the humerus. What was another muscle in this area that was anterior to the humerus? The biceps brachii. So the brachialis and biceps brachii are in the same body compartment. So what would be the motion of these two muscles? What's the relationship between these two muscles? One is on top of the other, one superficial and deep. But in terms of action, if they're in the same body compartment, they produce the same motion. If there are muscles that produce the same motion, then we call those synergist muscles. If muscles are in opposite body compartments producing opposite motion, we call those antagonist muscles. And in this particular case, right, since the brachialis is the muscle that moves across the elbow and the biceps brachii goes across the elbow and the shoulder, right, I would want to call the brachialis the prime mover of those synergist muscles. So the prime mover is the muscle that is producing the greatest motion of a group of synergist muscles. Right? So if you have the biceps brachii and the brachialis, since the brachialis is doing most of the work, we would want to call that the prime mover. Here's a really good muscle, easy to find in lab. This is the coracobrachialis. Coracobrachialis is nice because the origin and insertion are given in the name. So the origin is the coracoid process, right? And the insertion is the humerus, which is the brachium, right? When that contracts, that's going to pull the humerus toward midline. What do we call that motion with the humerus being pulled toward midline? That is adduction. So the coracobrachialis is going to be an important adductor. And if we want to find a muscle that's going to be antagonistic to the coracobrachialis, where would we want to look? One that is lateral, right? And it just so happens that the deltoid inserts into that, remember the deltoid tuberosity on the lateral aspect of the humerus, so the deltoid and coracobrachialis are antagonistic to each other. They're on opposite sides of the humerus. Okay, some other muscles that are antagonistic to each other. Well, here is that deltoid, right, going to the deltoid tuberosity, that's lateral. But this is the one that I wanted to talk about, the pectoralis major. The origin is on parts of the clavicle, the sternum, and even some ribs. And it inserts into the humerus, right? And when it contracts, it causes adduction, but it also causes flexion. But you know what? We got to review what flexion is at the shoulder because it's kind of strange. Who can show me what flexion is at the shoulder without hitting somebody? What's flexion at the shoulder? Flexion at the shoulder, keep your elbow straight, is like this. Okay? That's flexion. What's extension? Bringing your hands back down. Okay? So the pectoralis is important for flexion at the shoulder, and it's in the anterior compartment. Where would you find a muscle that will extend at the shoulder or extend the arm? Flip the body over and you're going to find the posterior thorax. Let's look at the posterior thorax. right, and that is right here. Right, and this is called the latissimus dorsi. It's in your back. When it contracts, it extends the arm. Right, so opposite body compartments, pectoralis major and latissimus dorsi, are antagonistic to each other. So if you want to learn some muscles, it's really good to learn them in pairs, just like that. What are some other antagonistic muscles? In the upper body, that's pretty much about it. In lab, we're going to learn about some muscles of the forearm. Okay, let's look at some muscles for the hip. Let's look at this one right here. All right, so here is the quadriceps. And I see here is the vastus lateralis. This is the lateral, most lateral muscle. Here's the medialis. And then the rectus femoris is on top, but it's been cut away. Oh, and I can see the tendon from the rectus femoris. It's cut away so that we can see this deeper muscle, the vastus medialis. All right, so that's the quadriceps. Lateralis, medialis, intermedius, and rectus femoris all have a common insertion into the patella, and that's going to pull on the tibia, and that's going to cause a kicking motion at the knee, which is, what do we call that at the knee, a kicking motion, flexion or extension? Extension, right? So quadriceps, prime mover for extension. Where would we want to find something that will extend? Right, so flex at the knee. Right, so quadriceps is for extension. Where are we going to find some for flexion? If the quadriceps is anterior thigh, we're going to look at the posterior thigh. So what muscles do we have in the posterior thigh? Right here. All right, so a nice gluteus maximus. Well, I'll point that out in lab. That's interesting because it's a posterior body compartment. Right, but here are the muscles. Right, for flexion at the knee. And there are three of them. These are called the hamstring muscles. And it's a semimembranosus, tendinosus, and another biceps. But it's not the brachii, because brachii means arm. Biceps here, since it's in the thigh, is called biceps femoris. And biceps, once again, because it has two origins. So these three muscles together have a name, sort of like the quadriceps. There are four muscles right there. These three muscles sometimes are called the hamstring muscles. Hamstrings, semimembranosus, tendinosus, and biceps. All right, so this part right here of the thighs is medial or lateral? That's medial. All right, and lateral over here. So if we start medially and we move laterally, what is the first muscle of the hamstrings that we run into? It is the semimembranosus. Right? That's how I like to remember this group of hamstrings. The most medial is semimembranosus. There might be other ways that you can memorize this. And then on top of it, or just to the side, is the semitendinosus. And look at this big long tendon of the semitendinosus. So that will be easy to pick out in lab. And then the most lateral of the hamstrings is the biceps femoris. Right? So if you start laterally, you bump into the biceps, start medially, the semimembranosus. And I always start medially. Right? If I haven't looked at this muscle in 10 years, I can figure it out because look at all these M's in semimembranosus. Right? So that kind of links up the medial muscle very nice and easy for me. Okay, so quadriceps and hamstrings are antagonistic to each other. Well, I really want to find iliopsoas, but I don't see iliopsoas anywhere. Let me just look just a little bit more. I just don't see iliopsoas muscle. Okay, in lab, we'll talk about the antagonistic muscles of the iliopsoas and gluteus muscles. That's going to be after the practicum. Right, so these muscles won't be on the practicum. Let me show you a really good website. There are links in Blackboard to it. Oh, I don't have a keyboard. Let me find the keyboard. It's called Get Body Smart. Hopefully I typed it in right. Okay, here's Get Body Smart. You can see there are a number of systems, skeletal system, and probably some of you have looked around on this website already because these links are in Blackboard. And let's take a look at the muscle system. And let's take a look at shoulder, forearm, wrist, hand, anterior thigh. There are a bunch of body compartments. And what can you tell me about opposite body compartments? Yeah, they're going to be antagonistic to each other. Okay, anterior thigh. Let's see what we got right here. All right, so here we see a bunch of muscles, kind of like what you see in your textbook. And what is really nice is that we can dissect some of these muscles out one at a time. And I wanted to show you the iliopsoas. Right? And the iliopsoas are these two muscles put together, the iliacus and the psoas major. Right? And the iliacus, is this kind of a familiar term? Iliac, ilium? Right, that is part of the ascoxae right here. So here is the iliacus, and here's the psoas. They join together. And are these anterior or posterior to this pelvic bone? They're anterior. So let's see what the motion is. Oh, no plug-in. Goodness gracious. All right, let me try this. Let me try a different browser. Okay, so here is that thigh muscle, and we can dissect it. We can move a bunch of these muscles out of the way by using the slider, and we're left by looking at the psoas and the iliacus. And if we want to just look at here's the psoas major muscle. And what's really nice is that we can see what motion it produces, right, which is, we call that flexion of the hip. Right, so the iliopsoas is a very important flexor of the hip, and it's anterior. Where would we find a muscle that is going to extend the hip? On the opposite side of the ascoxae. So let's take a look if we can find a muscle. Posterior thigh. Gluteus maximus, right? Right on the opposite side of the hip bone. Where's gluteus maximus? Yeah, I don't know what's happening. Something funny is happening. Well, that little guy would be able to extend. Okay, so here's the gluteus maximus. Right here, your hamstring's posterior. Gluteus maximus is posterior. This is going to be antagonistic to the iliopsoas muscle. And for some reason I can't get it to load, but let's just try it one more time. It's not loading properly. All right, but that's an important antagonistic pair that I want you to know. across the hip. Flexor would be the iliopsoas, and extensor would be gluteus maximus. Okay, well, the sign-in sheet is going around. None of these are working. Okay, sign-in sheet is going around, and I'll see you guys Wednesday. See you. Thank you, Jonathan. Got it.